Chapter 16, The New Millennium.
The millennium had come and gone, bringing with it neither the end of the world nor a new golden age.
Charlemagne's empire had disintegrated, together with his legend.
The papacy, too, was in a very insecure position.
Spiritually, because the Pope's primacy over the Church was contested by the Patriarch of Constantinople.
Temporally, because as yet there was no such thing as a pontifical or Vatican state.
And practically, because the election of a pope was still carried out in a very haphazard manner. There were no rules of procedure, apart from the consent of clergy and people, which applied to the election of any bishop.
In theory, the emperor, invested with spiritual and temporal powers at his coronation, could claim to represent the clergy and people of Western Christendom. But he was rarely on the spot when a pope died, and in reality it was the local Roman nobility who remained the most important single force in deciding papal elections.
In 1054, the spiritual dilemma exploded finally in what is known as the Great Schism. It was the definitive break between the Byzantine Empire and the Roman Church.
As the 11th century opened, Christendom was in a sorry state. Simony and concubinage among the clergy were two of the major evils. But reform was already in the air. It began in the monasteries, with Cluny leading the way, and soon afterwards came the reforming synods.
It was at one of these, held in the Lateran from 1059 to 1061, that a decree of Nicholas II established the exclusive right of cardinals to elect a pope.
We, Pope Nicholas II, decree and establish that on the death of the pontiff of this Roman Universal Church, the cardinal bishops shall first confer with most diligent consideration, and then shall summon the cardinal clergy to join them, and afterwards the rest of the clergy and people shall give their assent to the new election. They shall elect someone from out of this Roman Church if a suitable candidate be found. If not, he shall be chosen from another church. But if the perversity of evil and wicked men shall make it impossible to hold a pure, fair, and free election in the city, the cardinal bishops with the godly clergy and Catholic laymen, even though they be few, shall have the right and power to elect the pontiff of the apostolic see in any place which they shall consider most convenient. After an election has been clearly made, if the fierceness of war or the malignant endeavors of any man shall prevent him who is elected from being enthroned on the apostolic chair, according to custom, the elected shall nevertheless have authority as pope to rule the Holy Roman Church and to dispose of its resources.
When we speak of the Vatican today, we don't only mean the place where the pope lives. We include in our minds the whole administrative apparatus which surrounds the 20th century pope.
In the Middle Ages, the Pope didn't live in the Vatican, but at the Lateran, and it was there that the councils and synods of the time were held. The Vatican was simply St. Peter's and the surrounding area, including the Saxon Borgo, with its houses, workrooms, church, and cemetery.
But although the medieval popes didn't live above St. Peter's, they used the great basilica for all the more important religious ceremonies and for the solemn coronation of emperors.
On the 26th of March, 1027, Pope John XIX crowned Conrad II, Holy Roman Emperor, in the presence of two kings, one of whom was Canute of England, who was in Rome on a penitential pilgrimage. Canute wrote a letter from the Eternal City to Archbishop Alfris, full, we are told, of tender devotion to the Prince of the Apostles.
What Canute didn't mention was that the ceremony was not yet over when a violent argument over precedence broke out between the archbishops of Ravenna and Milan, developing into a street fight between the two factions. Another petty discussion followed, this time about an ox hide between a German and a Roman. The crowd became a mob. Blood was shed, and the final scene of the day saw the most notable Roman citizens, barefoot and trembling, standing in St. Peter's before the imperial throne, a naked sword dangling at their necks while they begged for mercy.
By the beginning of the 11th century, the peoples whom Christianity had brought into the main current of European civilization looked to Rome for spiritual leadership. Latin Christendom had gradually taken shape as a cultural and spiritual unity, and as this unity rested on a common devotion to St. Peter, it was natural that the peoples it comprised should look to the Pope as its head.
And in 1073 there came to the throne of Peter a man who had no doubts as to the supremacy of his position, a man whose pontificate is by general assent considered to be a turning point in the history of the medieval papacy. For with him came a new attitude, both to the place of the Church in society and the place of the Pope in the Church. The man was Hildebrand.
The story goes that as the body of Alexander II was being carried through the streets of Rome for burial in St. John Lateran, there was a sudden stir in the crowd. A group of men caught hold of a monk who was following the procession, pushed him through the ranks of guards and prelates, and thrust him onto the papal chair, while the throng clamoured wildly, "Hildebrand for Pope!" He was carried in triumph to the church of St. Peter in Chains, where in that period elevation to the papacy traditionally took place. And as the cardinals read the decree of election, bishops and nobles joined the cheering people in their unanimous acclaim of the new pope.
Hildebrand was no stranger to the Vatican or to papal activity. He lived through six pontificates and was minister to five popes. He'd been chaplain to Gregory VI, and followed him into exile in Germany in 1046. For some years afterwards, he lived as a Benedictine monk at Cluny, the most famous of the Reformed monasteries. But when Leo IX was elected, he brought Hildebrand with him to Rome. Because of his knowledge of local Roman conditions, the Pope put him in charge of the papal estates, to prevent them from being ransacked by the nobility, and to restore the papacy's material resources.
At that time, Hildebrand was only a subdeacon, and as yet his influence was not felt. But bit by bit, the popes came more and more to depend on him. He was certainly responsible in large measure for Nicholas II's decree on papal elections, and by the time Alexander II came to the throne, he was the pope's closest collaborator. A combination of today's Secretary of State and Cardinal Chamberlain, the first pope, in fact, to have come from what we know today as the Curia.
Hildebrand's programme of action is contained in the document Dictatus Papae, which he formulated during the Easter Synod of 1076. There were 27 points. A modern historian comments that these statements imply nothing less than a total papal sovereignty in all the affairs of the Christian community. And it's a measure of the greatness of the man who caused the six statements to be brought together that not one, except perhaps the last, is an idle boast. The Dictatus Papae is to be found in the volume of Hildebrand's letters.
The Pope can be judged by no one.
The Roman Church has never erred and never will err till the end of time.
The Pope alone can revise his own judgments.
He alone can use the imperial insignia.
He can depose emperors.
He can absolve subjects from their allegiance.
All princes should kiss his feet.
An appeal to the papal court inhibits judgment by all inferior courts.
A duly ordained pope is undoubtedly made a saint by the merits of St. Peter.
It's only fair to Hildebrand to mention that the Dictatus Papae was entirely personal and never intended for publication.
Nevertheless, Hildebrand knew exactly where he was going. For 23 years he had served the popes, influenced their decisions, and become the proverbial grey eminence, the power behind the throne. Once in office, he set out to make the authority of the papacy supreme throughout Christendom.